In the wake of that appalling massacre at Hungerford the other week, you probably are aware there's been a good deal of discussion about the control of offensive weapons. Douglas Hurd has recently announced some new regulations about the carrying of knives and the possession of firearms, which I guess most of us will welcome, even if it is a bit like shutting the stable door after the horse is bolted, as far as the people in Hungerford are concerned. But James, in this study passage we have before us this morning, he wants us to remind us that there is an offensive weapon, more dangerous than any flick knife or shotgun, which is not only widely available to the general public, it's owned and used by every single member of the human race. The tongue. How inconvenient it would be if we had to apply for a government license every time we wanted to use it. Yet words, says James, can lacerate just as cruelly as any sword. They can penetrate just as brutally as any bullet. In fact, if you want a weapon with which to compare the tongue's destructive power, a flamethrower is probably the most appropriate. For the tongue is a fire, James tells us here. A vicious, ravaging, indiscriminate napalm. There used to be a slogan during the war, careless talk costs lives. Well, James would have us know that it isn't just in a context of military espionage that that's true. Whether it were. Now, whether it's wartime or not, every time we open our lips carelessly, we are wielding a deadly weapon. Careless talk costs lives. So watch your tongue, says James. That's his advice to us in this passage. He expresses it eloquently, rhetorically, lyrically, poetically, but that's the essence of what he's saying. Watch your tongue. For to use your tongue irresponsibly is as dangerous as to spray the air with machine gun fire. And unlike the machine gun, the resulting injuries can't be repaired by hospital surgery. No, like the South American blowpipe, the tongue leaves poison in the wounds it inflicts. And that poison can go on festering and embittering the victim for years and years and years. So watch your tongue. That's our lesson for this morning. Everything we're going to be saying is summed up in that single phrase. And I have to tell you, I believe it's a piece of advice of enormous practical relevance to us here at Eden, even if it isn't to anybody else. As usual with James, it's not always possible to be sure of his logic. He tends to string his thoughts together in a rather discursive, unpredictable way. He uses flowery language. You can't always pin down exactly what he means. That's part of his style. But I think it will help us as we study these 12 verses if we divide them into three parts. First, we're looking at verses 1 and 2, where James homes in on a group of people to whom his advice about watching the tongue is particularly important, namely teachers. And then he gives us two general reasons why the tongue is so dangerous, which are equally applicable to everybody. The first, in verses 3 to 6, because the power which the tongue has for evil is out of all proportion to its size, he tells us. And the second, in verses 7 to 12, because experience proves that of all our human attributes, the tongue is the most difficult to control. So that will form the structure for our study this morning. Let's look first at verses 1 and 2, and this group of people that he picks on, to whom the command, watch your tongue, is peculiarly vital. Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, he says, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he's a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. I'm sure you're familiar with the quip that those who can do, those who can't teach, and its addendum, those who can't teach, teach teachers, and those who can't teach teachers become civil servants in the education department. Unfortunately, there is an element of truth in it. Not all who aspire to be teachers are really skilled in the giving of instruction. I remember one headmaster of a large grammar school in Essex who told me the most realistic definition of education he'd ever heard was that education was the inculcation of the incomprehensible into the incapable by the incompetent. And he put a heavy emphasis on the last word. Well, if incompetence on the part of teachers is a problem in secular education, James today wants to tell us an even greater problem and a more perilous hazard in the matter of our spiritual education. Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, he says. Clearly, among the early churches, teaching wasn't just a gift, it was an office, the teacher. He was an esteemed member of the congregation. And clearly, in the circles that James was writing to, this was particularly so, perhaps because he was writing to Jews. And Jews had always invested great prestige in the rabbi. So much so that the churches he was addressing seemed to have been in danger of having more teachers than pupils. Well, that isn't just wasteful of effort, says James. It's positively dangerous, because by no means all of these would-be educators are qualified for the task. So James begins this chapter about the tongue by inserting words of caution in this respect. Don't aspire to the role of a spiritual instructor too hastily, he says. There are big hazards involved, specifically. You know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. Now, of course, it's possible to interpret that in a purely human way, as a maxim that people who set themselves up to teach are likely to be in the firing line of other people's criticisms. We human beings have an innate dislike of authority, and if we can puncture the prestige of those who try and exert it over us, we will. People will certainly censure the teacher, more censoriously than anybody else, given half a chance. That's true. But I think those commentators are right who suggest that James is probably here not primarily thinking about the brickbats that the teacher gets from his congregation. He's thinking more about that assessment he's going to have to face in the future, at God's hand. To be a teacher is to occupy a position of privilege in the Christian community. And there is no privilege without an added burden of responsibility. Teachers are going to be judged by God, he's saying, by demanding standards. They're going to be judged more strictly. There are several reasons we might find for that. One, of course, is that the teacher can't plead ignorance in the way that maybe others can. If we've taught that such and such is right and such is wrong, then we expose ourselves to judgment by the same criteria, don't we? It's pointless us complaining to God we never knew it was wrong if in our teaching we have told others it was. Can't plead ignorance. A second reason why teachers are more vulnerable to criticism before God's judgment is undoubtedly because if there's one thing worse in the Bible than being a sinner, it is being a stumbling block. To fall into error ourselves is serious enough, but to lead others into error, that is inexcusable. Lord Chesterfield used to say, I'm told, that he would never give advice in matters of matrimony and religion, because he wouldn't have anybody's miseries, either in this world or the world to come, laid to his charge. Well, maybe his discretion was wise. Certainly Jesus says, woe to the world because of the things that cause people to sin. Such things must come, but woe to the person through whom they come. Better to hang a boulder around his neck and drop him into the sea, he says, than that such a person should face the judgment of God. But the particular reason James gives us in this passage why it's so dangerous to presume for the job of teacher in church is that the required spiritual qualifications are so very demanding. You see, a teacher has a necessity to do the very thing which we began this morning by saying was so potentially hazardous. A teacher has to use his tongue. Words are the stock in trade of the teacher. And whilst no doubt those words can do a great deal of good, they're also potentially a source of unparalleled evil. Don't be a teacher, says James, unless you're sure you've mastered the tool. We all stumble in many ways. But if anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect or a mature man, able to keep the whole body in check. Now, by keeping the whole body in check there, James could mean that a person who's in control of his tongue has won the victory over all his human passions. And he certainly says something along those lines later down in the passage. But it is equally possible, it seems to me, that he's saying that such a person is able to guide and instruct the whole body of the church. See, there's no word "his" in the original there. It simply says he's able to bridle the whole body. And since James in these verses is talking about the office of teaching in the church, it seems to me at least possible that he's using that word "body" in the same way Paul does, to mean the corporate company of God's people. Whichever way you take it, James is certainly telling us that when it comes to teaching in the church, the control of the tongue is a vital qualification for office. For none of us is infallible, he says. We all make mistakes, it's human nature. But errors that fall from a teacher's lips, they are particularly culpable, particularly dangerous. For they reproduce themselves in his disciples like spores of a toxic weed. Thrown into the wind, they multiply. So no one needs to watch his tongue more vigilantly than a teacher. That, of course, has very many practical implications and lessons that we could draw, doesn't it? It has relevance to those of us who already occupy a teaching office. Whether we're teaching children in the family Bible school, whether we're teaching the congregation as an elder or as a house group leader, or whether, as in the case of some of us, we are teachers at theological colleges and seminaries and things like that. We who teach will be judged more strictly. Those are sobering words, aren't they? We shall be judged not just by the quality of our own lives, but by the quality of the influence our words have had on others. We need to take our job most seriously then, don't we? Many of us, I think, don't realize how influential we are. We don't realize the weight which people place upon our words, far more than we intend often. We just can't afford to be careless. Some of you have mentioned that you notice that I bring rather a lot of notes with me into the pulpit when I'm going to speak. And you've commented that you see other preachers who manage to survive the pulpit with just half a postcard to their name. Well, that's perfectly true. I do bring a lot of notes into the pulpit. And the reason for that, I suppose, is partly because I'm not quite such a good preacher as some of you may think I am. I don't have quite that gift of oratory to whom words come easily. But more important than that, I've learned that I need them. Because I have learned how easy it is for people to misunderstand what you say. It's always the throwaway remark that gets you in trouble. It's always the unprepared remark but people twist. I prepare carefully because I want to reduce that misunderstanding to an absolute minimum. It can be so costly, so damaging. These two verses too have a great deal of application to those of us who may be aspiring to the teaching office, even though at present we don't occupy it. Not many of you should presume to be teachers, advises James. Perhaps there are some amongst us who are tempted to envy me my pulpit. Perhaps you think that you could do just as good a job as a preacher, a better job even. Well, perhaps you could. But if you're wise, I don't think you will solicit the opportunity too enthusiastically. Now, there are many days when I step into this pulpit and have to say that if you are envying me, my pulpit, I am envying you, your pew. Envying you the safety of your pew. Envying you the anonymity of your pew. Envying you the irresponsibility of your pew. And I sometimes think that I have to give account to God, not only for myself, but for Eden Baptist Church. I wither. Now, don't covet the elder's office unless you're sure you can cope with the knowledge that you're going to be judged more strictly. But thirdly, of course, these two verses have a very important application to us when we look to identify those who are being called to the teaching office, don't they? We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. There are no doubt many callings and gifts within the Church of Jesus Christ which are all valuable and important. But the teaching office requires a very special quality, precisely because it is a word ministry. And words are dynamite. When we look then for the qualifications for someone who's going to teach in church, we can't be satisfied merely that gross sins are absent from his life, that he's not an adulterer or a murderer or a drunk. Now, says James, in assessing a man's spiritual maturity, the tongue has a significance out of all proportion to its size. And that brings us nicely into this second section of our passage, verses 3 to 6. Why are we to watch our tongues so vigilantly? Well, two reasons, and the first is precisely that. That the tongue, though it is small, has potential for evil out of all proportion to its size. James' language is very rhetorical and poetic in explaining this to us. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Though they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise the tongue, it's a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. James is telling us here that it's very easy to overlook the importance of the tongue. Superficially it seems so inconspicuous, so commonplace. We use our tongues all the time. But it is actually, small as it is, it has huge power. The metaphors he uses for this are very striking, aren't they? The metaphor of a horse, huge, powerful beast. But it can be controlled by means of a very small piece of metal in its mouth, the bit. Or a ship, tossed about by the might of the tempest, but still the helmsman can steer it accurately by means of a very small rudder. Well, says James, in the same way, the tongue is a very small part of our bodies. It makes very big claims. It makes a very big difference to us. Just like a bridle or a rudder. It has a significance out of all proportion to its size. And if you've got any doubts about that, says James, then just consider the trouble the tongue can stir up. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body, he says. I guess all of us have seen those old newsreels of Adolf Hitler inflaming the German masses with his rhetoric. A great forest set on fire by a tiny spark. This is the characteristic of verbal evil. It's contagious. It's self-multiplying. It's like a depth charge dropped into the ocean. It sends shock waves through a whole community. And to expand on this evil potential the tongue possesses, you'll see that James in verse 6 uses three rather difficult phrases. Even in translation, their difficulty, I think, is apparent. He talks about the tongue being a world of evil among the parts of the body. What do you think he means by that? World is a rather odd word to choose, isn't it? We could make sense of a fountain of evil or a root of evil, but a world of evil. What's James getting at by using that unexpected word? Some people prefer to translate it adornment or decoration, because the word cosmos in Greek can bear that secondary meaning. And if that's what James intends, then I suppose he's saying here that a glib tongue is able to make evil seem beautiful, to adorn it, make it attractive, and so foster its growth among the unwary. Others think he's using this word world as an indication of the enormous quantity of evil which the tongue can unleash. Concentrated into its tiny form, he's saying, there's the huge dimensions of a whole universe of unrighteousness. Others suggest it's the diversity of evil which the tongue represents he's getting at. In this tongue, there is a microcosm of all shapes and forms of evil encapsulated into its scope. But for myself, I think, bearing in mind this metaphor of the fire which James has just used, I think possibly his chief thought when he uses this word world is that of an evil contagion. You may remember that in chapter 1 he uses the world rather in this way. He speaks about the need to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. He portrays Christians as needing to practice a moral hygiene because they recognize that their social environment is plagued by moral infection. Well, says James, that evil contagion which we call the world, which is all around us, it has an outpost of infection in every single one of us, right here in the middle of our bodies, the tongue. Nothing spreads so quickly as orally transmitted evil. Like a fire in a forest, he says, like a chain reaction, a nuclear bomb. It pollutes everything it touches. And that brings us to this second phrase James uses, which is rather difficult. It corrupts, he says, the whole person, or literally, it corrupts the whole body. It's difficult to see how actual physical organs can be affected by the tongue's evil, unless James is referring to some psychosomatic illness which the wrong use of the tongue produces in us. So either there he means body in the more general sense of personality, in which case he's saying that the wrong use of the tongue reinforces moral corruption in our character. It consolidates negative emotions. It makes us more committed to them. By verbalizing these negative thoughts and feelings, we actually entrench them in our personalities. Or else, he's once again using the word body in the same way as Paul, as a metaphor for the Christian church. It's not impossible that all the way through this passage, actually, at the back of his mind, is the idea of the tongue of the teacher. When the teacher's tongue is evil, it spreads evil through the whole body, through the whole fellowship. Whatever way you understand these difficult phrases, there's no doubting, is there, that the scale of damage which James sees as flowing from the tongue is vast. And that comes out again in this third difficult phrase. It sets the whole course of his life on fire. he says. Now this again is an attempt to render a very difficult phrase in Greek. Literally, James says, it sets the wheel of birth on fire. Well, wheel of birth no doubt made sense to James' first hearers, but it's a bit confusing to us. He could mean what we would call the wheel of fate, or the ups and downs of life. The tongue, he's saying, spoils the best and the worst of all that happens to us. It spoils the best because of its ingratitude, and it spoils the worst because of its complaints. Everything that happens in life is ruined by the tongue. Or he could mean, as our translation has rendered it, the whole course of life. In other words, the evil tongue, unlike many passions, isn't moderated or corrected by age. It dogs our footsteps from youth to the grave, as active and as potent at the close of our days as it was at the beginning. In fact, of course, often sins of the tongue are more obvious when we're old than when we're young, aren't they? Tragically. So the final thing James tells us about this evil, gross evil potential of the tongue is that its force of destructiveness is derived from the spiritual inferno. It is set on fire, he says, by hell. Someone has commented on that verse. Satan has his own Pentecost of fire. Whereas the Lord's Pentecostal gift produced tongues burning with good news and holiness, Satan's Pentecostal flame multiplies tongues of malice and unrighteousness. Well, here it is then, James' first reason for stressing the importance of watching our tongues. Because the tongue has a significance out of all proportion to its size. Don't underestimate it. It's easy to overlook its importance because it seems so innocent. But the amount of evil it can generate, the satanic access it can invite, it's incalculable, says James. Watch your tongue. But watching your tongue isn't as easy as all that, is it? In our final section of our passage, he tells us why. Because of all aspects of our human personality, sins of the tongue are the most difficult to master. Look at verse 7. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man, but no man can tame the tongue. It's a restless evil, full of deadly poison. The imagery here seems to be that of a venomous snake, which even when you think you've tamed it, remains treacherous and deadly. In the same way, James is saying, the tongue resists sanctification. All other parts of our personality we may be able to bring under control, but in some way the tongue is intractable. It won't yield to our moral control. It is a restless evil, he says, full of deadly poison. Sometimes, of course, that may be the poison of deceit. Whether we deceive in order to whether our deceit is a matter of exaggeration or in order to impress people or of evasion in order to avoid embarrassment, whether it's fabrication in order to have something interesting to say, even if it's false. All sorts of things can lead us into deceit. But lying can be a most persistent sin. Even in Christians of many years standing, it can still be there, habitual, besetting sin. Or it may be the poison of malice, which we can't tame. Within these four walls, just between you and me. I know I can rely on you not to let this go any further, he said. Such words don't really conceal the gossip, do they? It makes us feel so important to have confidential information to share. It's so difficult to discipline ourselves, so we really don't spread rumour. Or indeed say anything about anybody which we wouldn't be willing to say to them personally. And you find that weakness in Christians who in many other respects are outstanding. For some of us maybe it's the poison of obscenity. the smutty joke, the coarse innuendo, the four-letter word. It's a habit. But it's a habit that some of us find very hard to break. And for some of us, it's simple verbal diarrhea. You know, that perpetual monopoly of the conversation that not only bores other people, but disregards them by its perpetual interruption of what they want to say. One of the classic symptoms of self-obsession, isn't it? To talk too much. Dryden's famous epitaph on his wife. Here lies my wife, here let her lie, now she's at rest and so am I. For some it's the poison of anger. For some it's the poison of ingratitude. For some it's the poison of pomposity that's never able to say sorry. All kinds of poison that the tongue gives rise to. But whatever particular form of verbal evil it is, it all offends, it all hurts, it all causes damage. And the trouble with the tongue is it goes on spreading that pernicious venom, even in lives that are otherwise remarkably victorious over sin, says James. It seems to be untamable, this particular problem. Like a perennial weed in your garden. You dig it out, the next year there it is again. So James says, nobody seems to be able to tame the tongue. Its evil seems to be resistant to every form of human control, more difficult to master than any other aspect of our human personality. Which is why, he says, if there is inconsistency in a person's spiritual life, some corner as yet unsanctified by God in him, then you can be sure it will become apparent, if nowhere else, in his speech. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men, he says, who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be, he says. Been following this series, you'll know that inconsistency is one of the themes James is always hammering on about. In chapter 1, he talked about inconsistency in our devotion, that would pray for something but not really believe in our hearts, doubt in our hearts that we were going to get it. He talked about the inconsistency of our Bible study, that will open the Word of God and read it but fail to apply it to our own lives. He talks about inconsistency in our attitudes to people, treating the rich man one way and the poor man another. He's talked about inconsistency in our practice, believing one thing, but doing another. Well, here's one more example of this kind of self-deception. Inconsistency in our speaking, he says. Saying one thing in one place, and another kind of thing altogether elsewhere. I guess it's John Bunyan who caricatured this kind of hypocrisy most beautifully in his Mr. Talkative in Pilgrim's Progress. Let me just read you Christian's appraisal of Mr. Talkative. He talketh of prayer, of repentance, of faith, and of the new birth, but he knows but only to talk of them. I have been in his family, and have observed him both at home and abroad, and I know what I say of him is the truth. His house is as empty of religion as the white of an egg is of savour. There is there neither prayer nor sign of repentance for sin. He is the very stain, reproach, and shame of religion to everybody that knows him. The world can hardly have a good word in all that end of town where he dwells through him. For the common people that know him say, a saint abroad and a devil at home. But of how many of us would that have to be true? A saint abroad and a devil at home. Pious words on Sunday, praising the Lord. Malicious words the rest of the week, cursing our fellow men made in his likeness. My brothers, he says, it shouldn't be. Of course it shouldn't be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring, he asks? Of course not. The brine would adulterate the drinkable water and render it all salty. So says James, no matter how voluble our spirituality, the other side of us proves that it's all a sham. Can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. It's the old principle, isn't it? Jesus enunciated it in the Sermon on the Mount. By their fruits you will know them, he said. Now, says James, there is no more significant fruit than the fruit of our lips. There is no more sensitive barometer to a man's true spirituality than his tongue. Why? Because no man can tame the tongue. It requires supernatural grace to subdue this unruly beast. The best we can do, in our own strength, I suppose, is to determine that we will say nothing, like some orders of monks who prefer silence to the risk of saying something wrong. I'm sure you know the little confession of Abraham Lincoln. I would rather remain silent and be thought a fool than speak out and remove all doubt. But that's not really the answer, is it? Just to say, I'm not going to say anything, I'm going to keep my mouth shut all the time. For the dumb man has no more won the victory over his tongue than the eunuch has won a victory over his sexuality. It's self-control we need. Total abstinence is no victory, is it? So who's the master horseman who can teach us to bridle our words? Who's the master pilot who can teach us to steer our conversation? James is telling us here it takes more than natural human ability to do it. There's no man who can tame the tongue. And that's why, of course, Jesus' mastery of the tongue was so spellbinding, so wonderful. No deceit was found in his mouth, they said of him. They wondered at the gracious words that came from his lips. Never man spoke like this man, they said. Always true, always noble, always humble, never undisciplined, never garrulous, never malicious. That was Jesus' words. No ordinary man can tame the tongue. Only the Son of God has ever shown us what true godliness of speech means. And he alone can enable us to master our own tongues. That's why the tongue is such a cardinal index of our spiritual maturity, according to James, you see. But insofar as we are still immature in Christ, still in the flesh, if you like, still characterized by our old human natures, our speech will show it, even if nothing else about us does, our speech will. Only insofar as we are yielded to the Spirit of Christ and experience his sanctifying power, only in that measure will our words declare our moral progress. It's out of the abundance of the heart that the mouth speaks, says Jesus. That's why by our words we will be acquitted and by our words we will be condemned. Words are the index of our hearts. Out of the abundance of our heart, the mouth speaks. So says James, you show me a person who is never at fault in what he says, and I'll show you a really mature Christian. I'll show you a person who's really subdued the power of sin within his personality by the power of Christ. I'll show you a person who is competent to teach others. That people like that are rare. So let not many of you become teachers, he says. Teachers have to use their tongues. So teachers expose themselves to great judgment. For For there is no part of our human anatomy more dangerous, more unyielding in its evil inclination than our tongues. Watch your tongue. I find it hard to believe that any of us, as we're sitting here, listening to what James has to say about this, haven't found ourselves assailed in our consciences about something relating to our tongue. And I'm going to have to leave it to you to work out what the practical application of these strict words, these strong words about the evil of the tongue means for you. Because I don't know many of you very well. But I do have something to say this morning to those who are members here at Eden, who I do know comparatively well. For this passage in the providence of God comes at a time in our church when it is enormously relevant to us. Many of you who are members of the church will be aware that there has been an atmosphere of criticism and of complaint amongst us in recent days. Some of us have been complaining about the music group. Some of us have been criticizing our house group leaders. Some of us have had complaints against the deacons. Some of us have had criticisms of the elders. Some of you have had criticisms of me. Well, no doubt we all deserve criticism. And God forbid we should be the kind of church where everyone is so hypersensitive that nobody ever dares speak their mind. But I have to tell you that these complaints and criticisms have not always been expressed wisely. They haven't always been spoken tactfully, lovingly. They haven't always been dealt with person to person between the individuals concerned. Instead, there has been gossip and backbiting and negative whinging. And it's done harm. It has hurt people. And some of that harm may well be irreparable. Some of the wounds inflicted, even though they heal, will leave scars permanently, indelibly. That's why the tongue is such a vicious evil. And if it continues, I have to tell you, we may find that in a quiet and less bloody way, we shall have inflicted upon ourselves an emotional carnage, just as tragic, just as pointless as the Hungerford massacre. A massacre which no law, however draconian, could prevent. For our bullets are our words, and our guns are our tongues. And there's no law on earth can tame those. Watch your tongue, then. It's for people like us that James wrote. Watch your tongue. Let's pray together. Have a period of quiet, and then I'm going to read to you some words from a spiritual classic called Ecclesiasticus, a book of wisdom that James might have known. Beware the gossip and the talebearer. They have been the ruin of many peaceable men. The talk of a third party has wrecked the lives of many and driven them from country to country. The talk of a third party has brought divorce on faithful wives and deprived them of all they labored for.
Whoever pays heed to such talk will never again find rest or live in peace of mind. The lash of a whip raises wheels, but the lash of a tongue breaks bones. Many have been killed by the sword, but not so many as by the tongue. Happy the man who is sheltered from its onslaught, who has not been exposed to its fury, who has not borne its yoke or been chained with its fetters. For its yoke is a yoke of iron, its fetters are fetters of bronze. The death it brings is an evil death. Better the grave than the tongue. So, as you enclose your garden with a hedge, and as you lock up your silver and gold, so weigh your words and measure them. Make a door for your lips and a bolt for your mouth. Beware of being tripped up by your tongue. For thereby you may fall into the power of a lurking enemy.